from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
This is about the Constitution of the United States and the facts that lead to the president's violation of his oath of office.
That was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi speaking a few weeks ago, and the impeachment process and President Trump's attacks on her have put Pelosi in the spotlight like never before. And coming up, we'll talk with the author of a new book on the San Francisco Democrat and her rise to power. It's called The Nancy Pelosi Way, Advice on Success, Leadership, and Politics from America's Most Powerful Woman. And it's written by one of the people who know her best, her daughter, Christine Pelosi. That's coming up after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has been described by The Atlantic as the most effective congressional leader of modern times. The San Francisco Democrat is also a frequent target of President Trump and his Republican Party allies, most recently for her decision to delay sending the articles of impeachment to the Senate. Her daughter, Christine Pelosi, has had a front row seat for much of her mother's political career and joins us in this hour in the studio to talk about her new book, The Nancy Pelosi Way, Advice on Success, Leadership, and Politics from America's Most Powerful Woman. Christine Pelosi is an attorney and also chairs the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus. And welcome, Christine Pelosi.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here. This is a loving tribute to your mother as a legislator, as a mother, as a grandmother, as a leader, totally unbiased, of course. No, let's go to that first of all. I mean, when you take on writing about your mother, people are going to say right away, well, how could this book be objective? How could it be partisan? And I guess the answer is it's not, nor should it be, really.
Well, they're objective facts. Nancy Pelosi was raised in a loving Catholic Democratic home in Baltimore, Maryland. She and Paul Pelosi met at Georgetown, fell in love, had five kids within 6 years and 1 week, raised us all, was a class mom, drove carpool, volunteered constantly in the Democratic Party, and then after an appointment by Mayor Joe Eliotto to the Library Commission, started becoming more engaged and involved as a civic official and as a Democratic official. Those are the objective facts. And what I wanted to do with the book was to show people that two things. One, that parenthood, motherhood was really her gold star and still remains her North Star. Her favorite topic is her grandchildren. And second, that for every new person coming to claim their seat at the table of power, you are standing on the shoulders of others, and others already look to you as a role model. So it's really important to get there and speak your truth as forcefully as you can and try to make as much of a difference with as many people and for as many people as you can.
Well, there's a lot of chronicled history here, both personal and political. I mean, without the kind of knowledge you had, we wouldn't have known about playing under Joe Eliotto's desk, you and your siblings. All those kind of details weigh in here. And also, even just locally, thinking about the Pelosi kids playing in the Presidio and Nancy Pelosi winding up on the Library Commission thanks to Joe Eliotto, and then going on to this extraordinary career, and quite a career it's been. I mean, when you think about all that she's done, and particularly you single out two things, bringing women to the table and affordable care. Those are really the two sort of gems or rhinestones in all of this. But also, you admit that there's a great deal of pride in getting an F from the NRA rating. Here's a question, though, with which to begin. All the power that your mother has ascended to and all that she's achieved, and it's, you know, quite a laundry list, to put it mildly, people are wondering what's going to happen now that she's up against really not only the Republican Senate, what's she going to do with the articles of impeachment, particularly when she's going up against someone who is deemed very calculating, Machiavellian, and ruthless, i.e. Mitch McConnell. Your mother is seen as someone who can be a great tactician and so forth, but what about that kind of power that she's now up against with these impeachment articles? Is she going to do a pocket veto with it, or is she going to hold on to it? Or everybody's wondering.
The most important thing that has happened over the past few months has been the growing consensus among the American public that no one is above the law, including the president, and that we all have a responsibility to make sure that people in public life are held accountable to the Constitution and to their constituencies. So when you look at the trajectory of impeachment and you look at how the situation with the president pushing the newly elected president of Ukraine to single out Joe Biden and his family, a 2020 presidential rival, for investigation. What you really saw was something that could not be ignored. And one of the things that I talk about in The Nancy Pelosi Way, which, by the way, was a book that was finished and already in copy edits in late September. And then all of a sudden, we found out about the Ukraine phone call. And
your mother did not want impeachment, in fact, at first.
And yet here the Times found us and the Times found her, and the facts really were such that it could not be ignored. So at the end of September, the impeachment inquiry began and, of course, led to the impeachment of the president in December. Now we'll see, as you see more and more people pushing for impartial justice. So we'll see what the speaker does with the articles of impeachment, and we'll see what the senators do and what Justice Roberts does in putting the Senate trial together in January and February. So I think it's going to be a very interesting time. And what we should always remember are two things. One, we're in 2020 now. We have an ongoing threat to the security of the United States with respect to meddling in our presidential elections, not just from Russia, but from various actors trying to engage in voter suppression and depression. And we have to be on the lookout for that and let American elections belong to Americans. And the second thing that we have to remember is that it's really important that the president stop trying to abuse his power and go against the Congress when it comes to laws that are duly passed by the Congress of the United States. They should be executed by the executive branch and not thwarted for his own personal ends.
You've said that your mother approaches talking to the president like talking to wayward children. I don't know if you meant the Pelosi children, but, you know, the idea being somehow that you have to talk to the president in a way that you don't normally talk to other politicians. And when she said she prayed for the president, a lot of people thought, how could that possibly be? And she was asked by a former Breitbart guy, do you really pray for the president? And she said, don't mess with me. I mean, she came right at him the way that people associate Trump to go at the media, almost, in a sense. I mean, she talked really tough.
I think that's a false comparison with respect. Speaker had just in a press conference laid out her constitutional grounds for impeaching the president of the United States. And a reporter essentially said, no, you're just doing this because you don't like him. Do you hate him? And so it was ridiculous. First of all, it's ridiculous to counter a constitutional argument with an emotional one. Second of all, it's incredibly sexist to do that to a woman leader, which you wouldn't see them do to a male leader. We have no evidence that they've ever done that to a male leader. And third, to refute a false argument that she somehow is acting with anything other than a heart full of love is not remotely the same as calling the press the enemy of the people, which is what Donald Trump does. So I want to be very clear about that. If a reporter is going to ask a question that contains a fallacy, that reporter should be challenged, as should any member of the public. That is fundamentally very, very different than saying the press doesn't have a right to ask questions and that the press is somehow the enemy of the public when, in fact, the press are guardians of our democracy. So I want to be really clear about that. Second of all, I didn't say that she speaks to the president the way she speaks to wayward children. What I said was when she speaks to the president in a firm and direct way, as her child, I certainly recognize that look, which said, you know what you're supposed to be doing. You know what your responsibilities are. And do not start using excuses to get out of doing the things that you have to do. And that is as true of me trying to get out of my homework or trying to get out of being grounded as it is for an elected official trying to get out of doing their official duties, which in his case is complying with lawful subpoenas by the Congress.
Talking to Christine Pelosi, and she's chair of the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus. Her new book is The Nancy Pelosi Way, very fashionable cover with her sartorial mother. I'm also struck by the fact that you say that your mother is the more drama, she becomes more calm. And in light of the fact that, according to some numbers I saw in 2018, there were a link to over 137 ads for campaigns and on Twitter that were essentially targeting your mother. One can expect in 2020 certainly a burgeoning number of political ads along the same lines. This creates calmness?
Well, when you have five children that you raise from diapers to degrees, when you have a constant drumbeat of homework and meals and responsibilities and coalition politics and aspirations of the kids to constantly balance, the more chaos there was in our household, the calmer and more serene she would be. So I watch her in her public life, and it's the same thing within her private life. When people are getting really, really jacked up, she tends to say the same thing. Be calm. We have a plan. Listen to each other. But becoming personally upset about negative ads against you is only going to fuel more self-doubt. And she doesn't trade in self-doubt. So what Nancy Pelosi always tells us from an organizing standpoint is don't agonize, organize. If those negative ads are out there against you, you can either internalize them and feel horrible about yourself, or you can externalize them and say, well, let me counter that with something positive. Let me counter that with the agenda that we are going to do for the people, lower healthcare costs, improved ethics, and of course, bigger paychecks and better jobs, not just gigs, but careers for young people and people of all ages.
You take us back in the book, Christine, to the early campaign, first campaign against Harry Britt, in fact, and talk about it in terms of weaving and whipping. And the word whip is certainly important here because your mother was a whip for a while in the Congress, but also the grassroots kind of organizing that she did and that she really became in many ways famous for. First campaign against Harry Britt, took it into the community, house parties, all that sort of thing. Has that been eclipsed now by especially social media and so forth? Do we need to have seen more of that, especially since Hillary Clinton was deeply criticized for not going to Michigan and not going to Wisconsin and not going to Pennsylvania?
Well, I'd say two things. First of all, it was a campaign where there were 14 people running for Sala Burton's seat after Sala passed and had endorsed Nancy Pelosi shortly before she died. We thought that Sala was going to live a lot longer. She had said to my mom, Nancy, I want you to run in the fall. The general election of 1988.
She wanted your mother to replace her.
She wanted her. It was the first time in history, actually, that a woman endorsed another woman to succeed her, and that worked. But Sala died 5 days later, so there was a special election. So we got together. I had worked for Sala Burton and for Phil Burton as a teenager in their offices and campaigns. So I took a semester off of Georgetown, and where some people spend their junior year abroad, you know, in Europe or as another continent. I spent it in San Francisco being part of the grassroots movement. We were all over the city, blanketing in-house parties. We did it the farm worker way, working with the people who had originally trained Cesar Chavez. It was amazing and electric, and it's something that we still do. Our house meeting hosts still sign Nancy Pelosi's nomination papers. She still does a quarterly politics and eggs breakfast with the grassroots and does a number of phone calls. We had the Red to Blue San Francisco headquarters set up in the Castro last year, and they did millions of voter contacts. So it's always the grassroots, and as I mentioned in the Nancy Pelosi way, she still meets twice a month with the grassroots, unfiltered by staff or consultants or pollsters, just phone calls, finding out what's going on, what are people hearing, what are people saying. And on social media, what is really resonating with people? And over and over and over again, we find that most of the Nancy Pelosi coalition, most of the Democratic coalition, it still centers around healthcare. These are people who are either are patients themselves, they're taking care of sick people, they're concerned about people with pre-existing conditions, there are parents who have lost their children to gun violence or to disease, and they themselves now have a permanent PTSD. So
that's why you won a lot more congressional seats and so forth.
Sure.
Let me ask you, though, about and I know certainly you make it clear that your mother is concerned about families, concerned about welfare, concerned about bringing women to the table. And actually, she did a kind of Emily's List of her own recruitment, if I may say so. But immigration looms over this upcoming election, and it looms certainly in elections throughout the country. There's a sense that I often think, in fact, of that debate with the Democrats all on stage saying, would you arrest someone who came into the country illegally or undocumented and so forth? How many of you would not? And every single hand went up. And there was a sense, I know, among many Democrats that this was not necessarily going to be helpful in terms of getting the plebiscites that they want to arouse. Let me have you just address that, if you would, that sense of immigration. Is there a plan here? Because the Republicans are talking all about no borders. They want, you know, complete free immigration, which is not true of the Democrats. Let's get that off the record, first of all. But they seem tougher. That is, the Republicans seem tougher under Trump, putting people in cages and so forth, but nevertheless tougher.
The plan is the Dream and Promise Act, which passed the House over 200 days ago, H.R. 6. It built on the promise of Dreamers and people who are here under temporary protected status for the first time in 24 years. It was an immigration bill that passed the Congress. I will give credit. It was 100% of the Democrats. Seven Republicans, not enough, but still seven Republicans, voted for it. And it really is the blueprint for the future because it decouples having immigration raids on one community in exchange for providing a path to citizenship for another community. And instead, it says, let's put our immigrants in a humane immigration system. So rather than talking about comprehensive immigration reform, it's talking about humane immigration reform, which is has many comprehensive parts to it. You're talking about securing the border. You're talking about family unification. You're not talking about ripping children from the arms of their parents. You're talking about a path to citizenship that includes people who are working, paying their taxes, and contributing to society. You're talking about people right now, including the Dreamers, who are and their parents who are serving in our military. I mean, some of the most horrific images that we have seen are not only the little children being separated from their parents, being told we're going to bathe your child, and then the parent doesn't see the child again, but also the deployed service member who went home and hugged his mom right before she was deported. That's just outrageous. That's just completely un-American. So I think
and this is a bill plan. That sits on Mitch McConnell's desk.
It sits on Mitch McConnell's desk.
However,
they had another march to his desk last month to remind him that it's sitting there. They could take it up and it would pass because Republicans and Democrats have the three B's together: business, Bibles, and badges. Business wants it because it's good for business. It's good for the economy. Bibles, and by Bibles, we also mean any form of religious treaties because the communities of faith want it. And badges, law enforcement wants it too. And with that coalition behind it, I think it can be a winning issue in 2020 for Democrats and for Republicans who believe in humane immigration reform.
You also have Democrats who are saying abolish ICE. ICE should not exist.
You have a handful of people saying that. Let's be clear. When I was a caseworker for Phil Burton and Sala Burton, we had something called the INS, the Immigration Naturalization Service, and we pushed them to it was under the Department of Justice. After 9/11, I was a chief of staff on Capitol Hill during 9/11, the most horrible day in modern American history. And one of the things that happened was that the Bush administration, rather than taking and the idea of a lean Department of Homeland Security with a cabinet-level position, they instead dumped 22 agencies, including the INS, into this new agency, and they created ICE. And so what happened was, rather than being under the Justice Department, where you had lawyers and due process and a fair day in court, you instead were under what has become essentially a deportation force. So I think that a lot of people are saying we need to reform the system. You know, Speaker Pelosi, who voted against the creation of the Department of Homeland Security and prefers the leaner model, I think a lot of people are looking to that. And I think what the grassroots and a lot of people are saying is, look, we need to make sure that immigrants have a fair day in court. There is just an article that came out in, well, next week's New Yorker talking about the translation crisis at the border, where a lot of people listening probably have been to jury duty. When you go to jury duty, they do one video for all the jurors that explains what jury duty is, and they do it in several different languages, and then you walk into a courtroom. They want to do that, but instead of for jurors, they want to make that for every single person who has a deportation case, and then have you walk into a courtroom without an interpreter and have the judge make a ruling on your fate. And that's just, again, counter to the notion that we used to have under the INS and that we could have again, which is that everybody who enters the United States deserves a fair day in court and deserves to understand what rights and responsibilities they are giving away when they plead to something.
We're talking again with Christine Pelosi, and her new book is called The Nancy Pelosi Way. I want to invite our listeners to join us. And in fact, if you have questions or comments for our guests, we do welcome your involvement in the program, and you can give us a call right now. That number is 866-733-6786. Be part of the program. Any questions or comments you have by dialing in at 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email questions to forum at kqed.org. A lot of questions coming in already. Skip says, why is Nancy Pelosi holding up the impeachment process by delaying sending the articles to the Senate? Now, this is not in your book, but any light you can shed on that would certainly be welcome.
Well, Skip, nothing's being held up. They don't go back to work till Monday. Everybody was had a two-week recess. They are working right now to set the parameters for a fair trial and for impartial justice. And so we will see what those negotiations yield. But I was a trial lawyer for 5 years here in the city of San Francisco, and I know a lot of people who've had jury duty or participated in the court process probably know you call ready for trial and the judge sits down and hammers out, okay, what witnesses are coming, what's our schedule, what's going on. That's the kind of thing they're doing right now without John Roberts, although at some point the Chief Justice who presides over the impeachment trial may be asked to weigh in on the efficacy of the evidence and the schedule. So we'll see what that brings next week.
Well, another listener writes, if no one is above the law, how does Nancy Pelosi justify supporting sanctuary cities, which are a violation of the law?
Well, sanctuary cities are not a violation of the law. The original sanctuary city ordinance that came out of San Francisco was specifically designed to protect people who were seeking legal immigration status and to make sure that they participated in the life of the community. For example, when I was a domestic violence and sexual assault prosecutor, there were a number of vulnerable victims that we dealt with every day. And if you had victims and if you had witnesses who were undocumented, the crimes against them or the crimes that they saw would essentially go unpunished. And so that's why law enforcement, the badges part of comprehensive immigration reform, says, wait a second, we are going to see that everybody in the community has a fair day in court. And that also means that if you are here undocumented and you're trying to get legalization status, you're trying to get naturalized, that in so doing, if you see a crime or you're the victim of the crime, that you'll have justice too.
Julian Castro has dropped out of the race, and now the only person of color is Andrew Yang in the presidential race in terms of the Democratic Party.
And Cory Booker.
I'm sorry?
And Cory Booker.
Cory Booker is still in the race, technically. You're right, though he hasn't been in the last couple of debates. But I'm wondering, you know, and Cory Booker has been one of those who is leading in criticism of the Democratic Party for all its talk of diversity. And your mother has certainly been a champion of that, and it comes across in your book. Doesn't look diverse, at least on the presidential candidate stage. We're about a minute away from break, but I'd like your thoughts.
The Democratic Party is very diverse. I think that the fight that I helped to lead to ban corporate PAC money at the DNC. That was my resolution. The blanket ban failed, but the ban on corporate PAC money that conflicts with our values did pass. We fought and we lost for a climate debate and for issue-centered debates that would have involved all the candidates. I still think that that's possible this spring, but I think it's very, very difficult when you equate support with money. You should equate support with support.
And here's a tweet from Barbara who says about Nancy Pelosi, she's fearless. Proud to call her my congressperson. We'll go to more of your comments and questions when we return. Christine Pelosi with us, Nancy Pelosi's daughter, an attorney, and also chair of the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus. Her new book is called The Nancy Pelosi Way. Feel free to join the program. It's 866-733-6786. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Christine Pelosi. She's actually presently chair of the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus. She has a book out called The Nancy Pelosi Way about her mother. And I think actually one of the best descriptions of her mother in the book is that Nancy Pelosi is a daughter of the New Deal and really had some disagreement with FDR on items like refugees in the Jewish homeland. But for the most part, I think she and her political lineage, her political pedigree can be defined in many ways by that. Her father, as many of you know, was the mayor of Baltimore. And also condolences because I know your Uncle Tommy, who was also mayor of Baltimore, passed recently. And we're taking your questions and comments. I got to say, off air for a few minutes, I was talking about the fact that the last time Speaker Leader Pelosi was on the air with me, we talked about money in politics. And it's come out now that just recently, Bernie Sanders has about $34.5 million donated in the most recent quarter. A lot of money is coming into two candidates who are refusing to take money from big donors. I'm talking, of course, about Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And that conflict continues to go on within the Democratic Party. That is, you need a lot of money, especially if you're going to run for president. Do you take it from just individual donations, or do you take it from all the corporations and all the, shall we say, institutional powers that might want to be behind your candidacy? And it remains, I think, a big division point within the Democratic Party. There are those who are arguing for purity and those who are saying, like Pete Buttigieg did, all this business about the wine cave. There's a good joke about Trump in a W-H-I-N-E cave all the time. I don't necessarily have to go there. But there's all that speculation about where the money should come from. And you actually have something, again, in terms of your own experience to say about this.
Yes. 3 years ago, I introduced at the Democratic National Committee a resolution to ban all corporate PAC money and to say that no corporate lobbyists could serve as appointed members of the DNC. If they want to run, that's fine, but they shouldn't be appointed, because in appointing a corporate lobbyist, you're essentially appointing a corporation. That lost, sadly, overwhelmingly. None of the people running for president supported it. None. None of the candidates for DNC chair supported it, except one, Sally Boynton Brown, who I nominated, a woman running, the former executive director of Idaho. But Keith Ellison didn't support it. Tom Perez didn't support it. So we lost. But As many times as my mother would constantly remind me, you can lose an election and win a campaign. And we won the campaign of the issue because almost everybody running for president in one way or another is redefining what kind of money they're going to take, how transparent they're going to be about it, and what lines they're going to draw. We did come back in the fall of 2017 at the Democratic National Committee, and we had a coalition of consumer advocates, because in our 2016 platform, it said five words: we oppose predatory payday lenders. I'm like, fine, then don't take their money. So we banned that. And Sandy and Lonnie Phillips, whose daughter Jessie was massacred in the Aurora movie theater, gun violence, just disaster in Colorado, they wrote and said we shouldn't be taking corporate PAC money from predatory givers. And that includes, of course, gun manufacturers. Now, gun manufacturers weren't giving to the DNC, but they were giving to trade PACs, and the trade PACs were giving money. So
let me just come in here quickly with a comment and get your response to it, because it's right on point. Robert writes, Nancy Pelosi prides herself on being a prolific Democratic Party fundraiser in the old school way, soliciting from the richest Americans and corporations. But this turns off custodians, truck drivers, nurses, and other average Americans. What would you say to Robert?
Well, Robert, first of all, federal candidates don't take corporate money, period. And end of story. You can't take corporate money if you're a federal candidate for office. Second of all, she raised $250 million last year. The vast, vast majority, over 98% of that, was from low-dollar donors. So I think we have to look at things in perspective. That's where most of the money came. And it didn't turn them off, because they elected a House Democratic majority that is over 60% women, people of color, LGBTQ Americans, that's fighting, among other things, for H.R. 1, the first bill, the most important bill, which is to reduce the role of corporate money in politics, to have public financing for campaigns, and to try to undo as much as they can before a Supreme Court case, undo Citizens United, which I would argue was the single worst decision of the Supreme Court in modern times.
We'll go to your calls. Let me go to Maria first. Maria, join us. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you. I was out in Arizona visiting relatives the last presidential election, and I was amazed to find that they were running ads 24/7 with your mom and pictures of San Francisco and how filthy it was. And, by the way, did not see one Hillary sign, Trump all over. And when I came back home, I said to my husband, we really do live in a bubble, and look what happened. So how does your mom plan to counteract those kind of attacks for this presidential election? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. All right, and we thank you for the question. Christine Pelosi.
Thanks, Maria. I think Arizona is a swing state. You have Mark Kelly running for U.S. Senate in a very, very strong race. You have a number of congressional candidates who won last time running for re-election again. So you will see a lot of Democratic signs this time. And I just want to say one thing about Donald Trump poverty shaming San Francisco or any place, really, because he did that in Baltimore against the late Elijah Cummings. He did that in New York City recently, too. We have a problem in our society. It's called income inequality. We need to fight poverty. We need to fight homelessness. But we can't do that by shaming politicians on one hand and then not giving the money and the resources we need on the other. And we also have to be very aware that what some in Donald Trump's administration want to do is some sort of an executive order that would involuntarily commit people who are mentally ill. And we have to make sure that we're fighting that on civil liberties grounds to make sure that we have good policy that comes out of this. But Arizona is going to be a swing state. There's going to be a very robust defense of the House Democrats, as well as advancing our presidential nominee and our Senate nominee.
The president of the United States said, Nancy Pelosi tweeted, Nancy Pelosi hates America. He calls her Nervous Nancy. He talks about her teeth falling out. I mean, all of these kind of personal attacks, as well as suggesting what the president seems to do in the way of projection of things about instability onto other people, especially people in public life. Again, this makes her more calm.
When he goes low, she stays serene. If the five kids she had didn't rattle her, random mean tweets aren't going to. Because what Nancy Pelosi said when she first ran for Congress, and people were saying a lot of mean things about her then, was, well, they can't take my children from me, so they really can't hurt me. And now, over the past decades, as she's worked hand in glove with parents whose children were taken away from them by gun violence, by disease, she has a responsibility to them, and she can't look into the eyes of those parents and say, well, I can't fight hard for you today because the president was mean to me. She has to stay calm. She has to have a modeling of the kind of response that is worthy of the children that we've lost and the children whose aspirations we're trying to fulfill.
And more callers. Marianne, you're next up. Welcome. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Christine.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say hello. I've been a longtime fan of your mother. I am a native San Franciscan. And when I was studying at USF, I taught physical education at Notre Dame de Victoire, where I believe you went to school.
That is a small world. My cousins went there. Four girls went to the Convent of the Sacred Heart, which for a total of 48 years between us, it's a lot of Catholic education. But wonderful to hear your voice, and thank you for your compliment.
I have 20 years of it myself. But, I knew your family at that time. And my father was on the Board of Supervisors during Jack Shelley's regime. So you're just bringing me back to all the San Francisco politics, which is so important, and I embrace everything that you and your mother are espousing. That's my comment.
Well, thank you for the comment, Marianne. It's good to hear from you. And since you were raising the Catholic faith, it's very important to your mother, remains important to her. What about the reconciliation or lack of reconciliation that some point out with the abortion issue? I mean, she is a pro-choice legislator. Joe Biden is also a fairly religious Catholic and also is pro-choice. How does that square?
I don't think anybody said it better than Mario Cuomo in his speech at Notre Dame, the former governor of New York, who essentially said that when you're a Catholic, you believe in the tenets of the church. But when you're an elected official, you are not an elected official representing the faith, the Pope. You are representing all of your constituents. And I think that there are a lot of people. As you mentioned, Michael, I chair the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus. It's in our bylaws that we are pro-choice. I have people in my caucus who pay the dues, and they write to me and they tell me that they are pro-life and that they appreciate that I always say at the beginning of every meeting, one of those choices is to have the child. That's all they want to hear, because they personally have a view of supporting the Catholic faith. But what they don't want is the government to have one view and force everybody else into it. So I think it's not necessarily how you see yourself as a Catholic or a Buddhist or a Jew or whatever faith you have, but it is, what role do you want the government to have? Do you want a democracy or a theocracy? And Nancy Pelosi, like so many pro-choice Catholics, is for a democracy.
And we're for another caller, and that's you, Abby. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Oh, I think they got my name. It's Patty, but okay. I would love to see money, going back to the a little early in the conversation, I'd love to see money taken out of politics. And I often find myself fantasizing about a democracy, our democracy, just having several months, maybe 6 months of debates where everybody who's running for president gets to speak and say their piece. And it's paid by the taxpayers on television. And that's it. And that's all that's necessary, without the culling by the press of who the best candidates are or whatever. People just state their story, state their platform, and people get to decide. That's the fairest way to do it, and I just don't know why that's not pushed more.
All right, Abby, I thank you for that call and appreciate it. I'm going to read some more comments. That was a comment, and here's a comment from Paula, who says, I can see no reason to send the articles of impeachment to that sinkhole that is the current Senate. Right now, nothing positive could happen, and President Trump would just crow about his innocence. And a comment from Ron, who says, it's admirable to refuse corporate money, but beating President Trump is far more important. And a listener tweets, and a question for you, Christine Pelosi, if no president is above the law, why did Speaker Pelosi decide to impeach President Trump but not President George W. Bush when she admits that she knew President Bush lied to the public about the Iraq war?
Well, I think that you didn't have public support for impeachment. I worked on, unlike a lot of people, I worked on the campaigns in 2005 and 2006 very, very closely. We pulled impeachment as one of our 6 for 06. I had the polls with me. I traveled all over the country doing my congressional candidate boot camps with AFSCME, labor union. We were trying to build support for a new direction in Iraq. I worked as the co-founder of the DNC Veterans and Military Families Council to encourage veterans to run. We had fighting Dems, 55 Democrats running for Congress as Democrats, all looking for a new direction in Iraq. The public support for impeachment simply was not there. People wanted health care more. They wanted health care more. They simply said, it is not what we want to do. So the support, it wasn't as if we didn't try to test it, because we did. It wasn't as if we didn't have candidates running on it, because we did. They did not win. The ones who won and created the majorities in 2006 in the House and the Senate simply were not for impeachment. And their constituents were not for impeachment. They were for health care. They were for a new direction. And after Katrina, which also had happened in the fall of 2005, they were for government that actually worked and was responsive to the people and not just for very wealthy corporate interests. That's what they wanted, and that's what they got. So it's not a matter of, well, why didn't you do it? The answer is because the public support simply wasn't there, and it wasn't as if we didn't try and test it, and it wasn't as if we didn't have candidates we were running who unfortunately lost, who would have been key voices in supporting it. This time, with the Ukraine situation, you would notice that it was the majority makers themselves, conservative district Democrats with national security backgrounds, who said, no, this is not the oath we took in the military. It's not the oath we took in the Congress. To threaten a foreign adversary with refusing aid passed by the Congress unless and until they interfere in a 2020 election. And that's what turned the tide. Public sentiment is everything, as the speaker said, and it simply wasn't there.
Recent polls show that the public sentiment has, after all the testimony and the diplomatic people that went, the testimony not including those, of course, who refused the subpoenas that were sent to them, nevertheless has gone down somewhat, according to recent polls.
Well, it depends what polls you it depends what polls you see, but there's still a majority of the people who believe that he should be impeached. Removal is different from impeachment, but in terms of the impeachment, those polls are all polling positively among Democrats and independents. Obviously, Republicans are rallying around the president, and it's also important to know that there are, you got to read the independents a little bit differently, because some of them are former Republicans who left.
Ben wants to know, do you have any insight into the recent string of exceptional images that have been captured of Nancy Pelosi, like the point at the cabinet meeting, the sunglasses, and of course, the clap? Are these somewhat planned, or are they just a result of your mother's charisma and honesty?
The funniest thing about these internet memes is that they are completely spontaneous. And by the time my mom has left the building, so to speak, or left the chamber, or left the meeting, they've already exploded as internet memes. And I'll call her and say, Mom, you realize you're an internet meme. And she'll say, what are you talking about? And I'll say, well, you pointed at him, or you did the clap, or you put your shades on. She said, I didn't even know that. So I think what's interesting is that this is the Nancy Pelosi we've always seen. No nonsense. Get to the point. Be clear about who you are. And she's not backing down. It is what makes her an interesting foil for this president, is that without even trying, she gets under his skin, because in many, many respects, she respects the office of the presidency far more than he does and expects him to do better.
Your reference to poverty shaming notwithstanding, though, San Francisco does have its problems with you know, we've heard it before, needles on the street, feces on the street, all these kinds of things. And when those criticisms come up, because your mother is so identified with San Francisco and the targets say San Francisco values, that's Nancy Pelosi, that's not what we want in this country and so forth, what's her response, especially when it gets local like that?
She's very proud of San Francisco values. She talks about the prayer of St. Francis all the time, make me a channel of thy peace.
Yeah, but the needles and the dirt and all the rest of it.
Which are ubiquitous. I mean,
homeless
on the
street. We have more homeless in California than anywhere else in the country.
However, there are homeless people just about everywhere. And if you look at the attacks that were on Baltimore last summer, they were made at the same time by the father-in-law of a Baltimore slumlord. If you look at complaints about homeless people, they have them on the streets around Mar-a-Lago. So if what you're trying to do is say we want to lift people out of poverty, we want to give people other opportunities, we have to deal with persistent poverty, we have to do things like just happened in San Francisco. I'll speak for me in my community with the Navigation Center on the Embarcadero, which I supported and wish we had had sooner. And as the mom of a young girl in San Francisco public schools, where one out of every 25 public school students in San Francisco is homeless, and many others are housing insecure, we have to do more. And so I think the answer is to bring in more resources, bring in the wraparound services that I worked for when I worked in the Clinton administration at HUD, the continuum of care for people. That's what we need to do. But simply showing a picture of a poor person or of a mentally ill person and then trying to use that image as a political football is profoundly disrespectful. And I just think our society has to dig deeper and be better than that.
And we'll bring another caller, and that's Dorothea. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Hi. I would like to know what Nancy's doing in terms of the rising anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism in the Democratic Party on the extreme left. And, you know, it's a three-pronged anti-Semitism that's growing in this country, from extremist Muslims and from the white supremacists, of course. So I'd like to hear what she's thinking and how she's going to keep the party open to all of us. Thanks.
Well, thank you for the question. And I should say my married name is Kaufman. So my Jewish husband and his family, the Kaufmans, are obviously very, immediately concerned about this anti-Semitism. We talk about it all the time because my daughter Bella's last name is Kaufman. We talk about that when we're traveling. What would happen in terms of her safety, in certain places? And I know that there are a lot of communities that are feeling under attack and feeling that under this administration, a lot of the racism and anti-Semitism and homophobia and Islamophobia has really ratcheted up to unacceptable levels. And there is a real fear right now, I think, that people expressing their Jewish faith are under threat. And it is deeply, deeply concerning. And as to where the Democratic Party is concerned, speakers made it very, very clear that we are the party of pride, not just tolerance, pride, diversity, and inclusion, and that we will continue to be so. And the very strong connections that we have, both personally, community, and politically to the Jewish community, are going to remain very, very strong. I also think it's important to note that, again, in terms of what we can do with our public voices, is to constantly speak out against the hate wherever we see it, including most recently in New York at the Hanukkah stabbing, but also that in the budget, which should be a statement of our values, that we try to do, as the speaker has tried to do and the president still refuses, to restore the money to the anti-terrorism funding so that we can be able to identify these larger conspiracies and hotbeds of hatred and try to douse them and try to promote healing and education in our schools at the earliest ages.
Again, we're talking to Christine Pelosi, and her book is called The Nancy Pelosi Way. And one of our producers wants to know, are you considering running for office? Would you consider running for office?
I love running for party office. In fact, I'm running right now for re-election to the Democratic National Committee.
But that's within the party.
That's within the party, and that is what the Speaker of my House, Bella, is comfortable with. She likes being the boss of me, and much as we respect public service, now with a 10, almost 11-year-old now, is not the time in my family. But I might consider it later.
Actually, there's a great story in your book where your mother is considered running for office, and she asks Alexandra, your younger sister, who's in high school at the time, I believe, and was concerned about teenage things, as one would be in high school. She basically said, get a life, Mom, right? When she asked her, should I run for office? What do you think?
And Alexandra said, Mother, get a life. And so that was her way of saying, as a teenage girl about to enter my senior year in high school, I'm perfectly happy with my mother being out of town 3 to 4 days a week.
Yeah.
Bella hasn't given me that that speech, that permission yet. So
she hasn't moved into adolescence yet. So
she has not. So she still wants her mommy and I still want my girl. So we're going to the closeness of an everyday. So but it really is an honor. And I will say to everybody running, it's not for the faint of heart. It's really tough to get out there and do. Make sure your family's on board. I worked for a family that was running for office, and I asked the wife one day as I was driving her around to events, are we going to see some of your friends here? And she said, oh, no, we don't ask our friends for money. And I thought, wait, you're asking me to ask my friends for money for your family? Why don't you do it? So you really have to be on board all the way 100%. And if your family's not ready, there are many other ways for you to serve. But the most important thing, I think, is, and this is something my mom taught us a long time ago, is, you know, being a parent is an implicit promise to make the world safe and fair for your child. And so however you choose to answer that call to service, whether it's in party office or public office or civic engagement, I think it's really always important to have a quality of life in your home so that you can get out there and defend that for other people. So be sure that you're tending to your family life before you start taking care of America's families. A lot of people are good at humanity, but not necessarily other humans. And one thing I love about my mom is that Nancy Pelosi is good at both.
Well, you've distilled a lot of your mother's wisdom in this book. One of the most important lessons is comes across as Nancy Pelosi was a great believer in being as authentic as you can to whomever or whatever you are. Let me get Kelly on here as the next caller. Kelly, join us.
Hi. I just have a comment. I wanted to mention that, I've always had great respect for Speaker Pelosi, but I wanted to share the moment I fell in love with her. It was in 2008 during the financial crisis. And on the news, we saw the room full of leaders discussing the crisis on television. And Speaker Pelosi was there and Barack Obama was there. And she stood up and she kind of deferred to Barack Obama like he was already president, like it was done. And I thought, that's what we need more of, people who are willing to put the country first rather than their own egos. And that's when I fell in love with her.
Well, thank you for that call. Kelly, good to hear from you. Let's hear from another caller, and that's Michelle. Michelle joining us. Good morning.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. This is a little bit out of order, but one of the things that has really impressed me is what an education it is to listen. And I really want to get her book, and I love Nancy Pelosi, and I hope I see her in the future in politics. The thing is the education I got was with West Wing, what really happens in the White House, and then Madam Secretary, what happens really in the State House. And coming from a military background, I know a lot of people on the conservative side and moderate side, independent. And when they talk about Biden, Biden is a non-issue around Ukraine, and because there's all this information that's traded, even though I know that it was used as blackmail or extortion. But why do we keep on bringing up Biden when the more important issue is the national security of the United States? And even Nancy said something about that in her speech about it. Why does it keep on falling to Biden focus rather than the national security?
Well, thank you for your family's military service. I think it's really critically important that all candidates remember and voters remember we're voting for the commander in chief. It's not just the president of the United States. It's not just the leader of a party. It is the commander-in-chief and the person whose first job is to keep us safe. And I think that with respect to Ukraine, as the speaker said to the president, with him, all roads lead to Putin. Why were they pushing Ukraine? Because it was something that would benefit Putin. And we have to make sure that the next president of the United States is keeping our safety, our security first, is only sending our forces into harm's way with a plan, with an exit strategy, with a diplomatic backup, and also making sure that we're respecting the sacrifice of military families who are still only a very, very, very small percentage of our population who are bearing most of the burden of our decisions when it comes to national security. So I think you're 100% right that needs to be a high focus, and that should be something that we take into this discussion in January and February.
There are many who think your mother is 100% right in saying all roads lead to Putin, or all things seem to lead to Putin. But the real question in many people's minds is why all those things lead to Putin. Well, let me get another caller on here. Phil, go ahead. You're on.
Yes, I want to say that I think that your mother's legacy is going to be very poor. She has ignored the people in the flyover zone. She got a 1,400-page ACA passed. 63 members of the House lost their seats as a result of that.
Phil, you got a whole list of things, I think, but I don't know what we have time for here. But take the criticism he just threw at you here.
Well, it would have been a perfectly good criticism in 2011 before she spent years defending the Affordable Care Act, rebuilding the party, and winning the House. It was ironic, actually, and I talk about this a lot in the Nancy Pelosi way, the original fight for health care, one of the things that was missing, there's two things that were missing. One is it was the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, and we stopped talking about the patient protection part, the patient's Bill of Rights, which was the most popular part. So shame on us. But also the grassroots out on the mall were all Tea Party people against it. This time, when they tried to save the Affordable Care Act, Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, and they did, it was because the grassroots and the air cover was coming from patients who wanted their care to be protected. It is still under assault now. So I would say, in fairness to Philip, that would have been a fair criticism in 2011. But we are now hundreds of victories from that. The Affordable Care Act, and with its patient protections, is still alive and hanging on. And I think that ultimately that will have saved millions and millions of American lives.
I'm going to read one final comment from Christina. Says, I've not been a fan of Nancy Pelosi and her approach of rising above. It's like playing baseball with a football. You must play the game, same game, with the same vigor and commitment. But her approach to waiting for the proper time to send the articles of impeachment to the Senate made me admire her for the first time as a warrior. Thank you, Christine Pelosi. I'm Michael Krasny.
Thank you.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.